Welcome to the Andy George Leadership Podcast. This is a podcast that is all about helping you reach your potential, define your purpose, and to live with passion. Well, I'm really excited about this episode of the Andy George Leadership Podcast. And before we jump into my very special interview with former Major League Baseball player Pat Watkins, I want to encourage you that if you've not done so yet, make sure you subscribe to this podcast. You can also go over to andygeorgecoaching.com for more information. Well, as I mentioned, this podcast is a special episode. It's an interview that I had recently with former Major League Baseball player Pat Watkins on teamwork and on leadership. And I know that you are going to get a lot out of this podcast. So I hope you enjoy it. And here we go with my interview with Pat Watkins. Well, hey, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us on this podcast. Listen, I am so incredibly excited to be talking with and interviewing my friend Pat Watkins on leadership and teamwork. Pat, thank you for being here and welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Hey, thanks for joining us on this podcast. I'm excited to talk about teamwork. I think when we talk about leadership and teamwork, don't you think those two things go together pretty hand in hand, correct?
Yeah, I mean, every team I've ever been on has always had a, you know, sometimes a vocal leader, sometimes a subtle leader, but leader nonetheless.
That's right. So one of the great things I wanted to have with you on the program and really talk about is you've got a very interesting journey, a very exciting journey that really lends itself to not only individual leadership, but also to teamwork in your journey towards Major League Baseball and then out of Major League Baseball into the business world. So why don't you take a few minutes and just tell everybody where you're from and maybe just a highlight reel of your journey, particularly in baseball.
Yeah. So I actually grew up in a real small town outside of Raleigh called Garner, North Carolina. It's the center of the sports universe, if you don't know it. It's a, you know, it's a mecca. But just grew up in a really great, solid home. My mother and father were both public school teachers. My dad was a basketball coach, and my mother taught history and drama and law and justice and psychology, to name a few. But one of the things that she did when she was in school was she was in charge of the student government. And she recognized really early on the lack of leadership training in high school kids. And so she actually created a trip. And we call it the Ashborough Retreat because she takes about 150 students every year to Ashborough to Camp Caraway and puts on a three-day-long kind of leadership retreat. And when I was young, she started. So I got to actually be involved in that throughout my middle school and high school career and end up being the chairman of that retreat later on. And that was kind of the foundation for me of solid leadership. And it's unique to get that in your home, especially out of your mother. And, you know, after Garner, I was blessed to get a scholarship to play baseball at East Carolina University. And I went in there with a really good baseball program. And it took me a few years to kind of get my feet up under me. I was actually young. I went to college and I was 17. So I should have been redshirted. I still, you know, complained about that to my dad. I said, why did you not hold me back? He's like, because you were ready. That's why. And so I went to East Carolina and you know, played a little bit my freshman year, junior year started. And going into my junior year, had a really, really good year and got drafted. Actually in the first round by Cincinnati Reds and started my minor league career in Billings, Montana, hit several sites like Winston-Salem, Chattanooga, Tennessee, Louisville, Kentucky, Indianapolis, Toledo, Ohio, just a small town and larger town minor league career and finally got a call up to the major leagues in 1997, made my debut against the Chicago Cubs at home in Old Riverfront Stadium, if you know, if you're familiar with Cincinnati, and got my first hit against the Philadelphia Phillies, and you know, played parts of the 3 years in the big leagues, and in my last 2 years, we're back down in the minor leagues, and I realized quickly that at my very best, I was a backup outfielder, and eventually, I'm gonna have to go get a job. I would not make enough money in this game to never have to work again, so. By that time, I'd met my beautiful wife, Anna, and we were wanting to start a family at some point. So I made a decision to not play baseball anymore. Some people call it retiring. Some people call it not getting offered a contract. But either one, that's what I decided to do and started my real world life at the age of 32.
There you go. Man, that's an incredible journey. So you obviously played on multiple different teams. You had different coaches, different teammates. If you look back on it, Pat, what were some of the coaches and or teammates that you had that you felt maybe were an unhealthy coach or an unhealthy team? What are some of the characteristics that you noticed right away going, okay, that's unhealthy. That's not a healthy team. That's not healthy leadership. And then obviously the opposite question, what are some of the things that you saw that were extremely healthy being on a team?
Yeah. I think if I look back on the coaches that influenced me the most were the ones that got to know me as an individual, because you cannot blanket a philosophy or the same way to lead everybody, because everybody's different. And the ones that really engaged and got to know the individuals, because, you know, specifically baseball is a individual sport masquerading as a team sport.
Wow.
And
so talk about that for a moment. That's a pretty great statement. So what does that mean?
Yeah, it means that when I'm at the plate, there's nobody out there helping me hit. If I'm playing shortstop, there's nobody going to help me field a ground ball.
Yeah.
But collectively, I got to have a first baseman to throw it to.
Yeah.
And I got to have somebody to, you know, as a pitcher, I got somebody to catch the fly ball that I just induced from a batter. And then collectively, all these individuals have to work together to make the team better. Mm-hmm. And so baseball has always been a great analogy for me for leadership. Wow. Because the fact is that you can't treat a first baseman like you can a shortstop. It's just completely different. And so if you get to know them and know what they need to work on individually, and so at the end of the day, the collective unit has a purpose, which is in this case to win a game or to win a championship, you start to see the little subtle movements toward that goal, and not come in and yelling at everybody, because everybody didn't make a mistake. You know, everybody didn't respond to that yelling the same way. So, the better leaders were ones that are really engaged on that individual level, got to know my individual strengths and then play to those.
Man, that's a great analogy, really good analogy. So how do you think that works into the business world? Obviously you're working at Cisco now, you're in more of the business environment. Same idea, you're on a team, you see multiple teams happening. How many of those same principles transfer over to right now today that you picked up playing baseball?
Oh, I use the individual masquerading as a team sport analogy a lot in business, because I just take a look at my team that I lead at work. I have 6 people across the Carolinas and Tennessee, and they all operate in a little bit different way, but collectively we have to come together for our region to hit their plan. And so it's the exact same thing as a baseball team would be. And so by doing the same things that my successful coaches did for me with them, our team has become really successful. I am purposeful in setting aside a time to get to know them one-on-one, get to know what makes them tick, what makes them what they get up in the morning, what do they drive for, what is their passion, what is their purpose. And then once I know that, then I can kind of lead them individually. And if you spend the time individually, you know, helping them get to where they want to be in life and in business and all together, then they come together in the unit of a team, all bought in for you as a leader. And that servant leadership that you can show them on a day-to-day basis, just getting them in their lives, really pays off in the end. You start to earn this subtle equity with them. When you really, really need something and you really need the team to come together, you have the equity to go tap into to really drive home an event or a program or whatever it is down the line that you really need for the team. But you have to put the work in beforehand to get that equity.
Right. So let's talk about that for a moment, because as any team, just like in baseball, you lost games, right? The Cincinnati Reds lost games. They weren't 100%. How in the majors versus maybe college and little, you know, playing in little leagues, how do you handle losses? Because it's just as much a part of the game as winning.
Yeah, no, it's a huge part of the game. And that's the one thing that I pull out of baseball is that I'm more thankful than anything is the ability to handle the ups and downs. Baseball is a really unique sport where it's a game of failure. I mean, you literally fail more times than you succeed. The greatest players in the world fail 7 out of 10 times. they could take a right at first base instead of taking a left. And if you think about that in life, that doesn't happen in life. You're going to fail in life, but you don't fail that much. And right. So what it taught me was the ability to handle the failures. And as a leader dealing with failure among your team, and this is really a parenting tip or whatever you want to call it too, is as a leader of my household, as a leader of my team, I have to be steady. You know, if I'm steady, I'm the same whether we win or lose. The team or the business or life will take you with the ups and downs, or the game will take you up and down. But I want to be the steady force, because if I'm going up and down, the team's going up and down, we never can sink. So I want to be the foundation of stability among the team. And by failing as much as I had in the past with baseball, just learning how to be steady. You know, my goal as a parent, and I have a son who plays baseball, and my goal is I shouldn't be able to tell whether he goes 0-4 or 4-4 after the game. I got to be the same, because as a parent, I don't want him to equate my love for him with his performance on the field, just like I wouldn't want my team to equate, you know, my support of them on how they handle one project or whatever. This is a long journey we're trying to be successful at.
Yeah, well, that's really, really good. And great connection to parenting, great connection to individuals. So let's say you're working with your team and you've got an individual on your team that is not pulling their weight. So how did that work playing Major League Baseball? Because I'm sure, once again, even though everybody's out there, they're at the highest level, did you ever have anybody on your team that you would look at and go, man, that guy's not in the gym, he's not working hard, he's slacking? How does the team deal with a person on the team that has the potential but just isn't performing?
Right. No, I think in Major League Baseball, you find yourself waking up in AAA.
But isn't that similar in business world too, though? Right?
Yeah, if you're really not on
your
is,
weight,
yeah.
I mean, you're going to the mailroom, you know.
Yeah, it's a numbers game. I mean, yeah. It's in sales where my team is. There's a scoreboard, and you know if you're doing it the right way, you're not getting the job done. But here's my especially in business, this is my kind of statement that I have for my team, is I don't view success as hitting your plan, because if you just shoot to hit the plan, you'll never shoot to exceed the plan. Mm-hmm. So success to me is not plan. Success is, did you extract everything you can from your territory or your region or your customers or your whatever your world is? Did you extract everything you can from them this year while building for the future? Because sometimes that might be 80%. I can look at it. I've had a guy on my team that finished at 80% to his plan. He felt like it was the worst year ever, but I knew what he did every day. And I said, you had a great year. Mm-hmm. I said, your paycheck might not show it, but you had a great year. So if I just judge success by whether you hit your goal or not, that would be short-sighting everything. And vice versa, I've had people that have finished at 110, 115% of their plan, and I knew that they had 140 or 150 in there.
Right.
They stand back for next year, and I viewed them as unsuccessful because they didn't extract everything from their territory. And so it's, you know, as a leader, you want to make sure they understand what success looks like. And for me, it's not a plan. That's an arbitrary number given to them by my company.
Right.
To view success. So, you know, it kind of changes the narrative a little bit.
Yep. That's really good. And so as the team leader, what is your style of motivation? And same kind of question, what have you seen from maybe other bosses or leaders that has been a very poor example of somebody trying to motivate? Because everybody motivates differently. And I'm thinking back in my head of either coaches I had or bosses I had or my kids' coaches. And you see some coaches, their motivation is kind of fear-based where they're yelling. And you got other ones that are almost too much of a friend. And so nobody takes them serious. So what have you noticed when it comes to team motivation that works well for you? And what have you seen that you just know just doesn't work?
The ones that don't work are the passive aggressive or the extreme of the hard driver pushing all the time. I kind of view mine as a middle ground of transparency for me. I think honest and real, and sometimes they're uncomfortable, but I've learned throughout leading teams, especially in the business world, that if you're just honest and transparent and you've put the work in to get to know them and to get involved in their lives and get to know what's going on, you earn the right to be honest and transparent with them. And I think at the end of the day, it might be uncomfortable. I've had people in front of me that I've been honest with about their performance or about something they've done wrong and been in tears. And later they come back and say, I needed that. I needed to hear it. And if you come from a place of goodness and honesty and say, hey, look, this is not to make you feel bad about yourself. This is to make you a better person so you can go home and provide for your family. And it comes from a genuine place. You can never go wrong with that. And so for me, whenever I had to, you know, deal with a bad employee or something that's going on, I just sit and just be real with them and just be honest and transparent and let them see what the world is seeing or show them what the world is seeing from their performance and the brand that they have and how it's being viewed, the optics, because a lot of people, and you'll see this in every walk of life, but a lot of people just don't have the way to view themselves without being obstructed from their own view, the ability to self-reflect and see how the world is viewing this. So you sometimes got to be honest and just and show them and tell them what it is.
So what does a toxic team look like? A team that's toxic. What does that look like?
Yeah.
How does that play out in whether it's sports or in business?
Right. No, and it's really easy to see it in sports. It's I'm going to get my mentality. I'm going to get mine. I don't care what you do. I'm going to get mine. And usually you see those guys, they're pretty evident where if they didn't have a good game and we won, are you celebrating? That's a real, real great litmus test. Or we lost and you had a great game. Are you celebrating? Those are real easy to spot. In a business world, it might be a little harder to spot sometimes because, you know, the scoreboard doesn't show every day. You know, I view it by how engaged are you with other people? How are you? Are you looking to help? Are you mentoring? Are you you kind of isolated yourself? And when I talk to you, you're not as honest and upfront and you know, so you got to look for the little subtle hints that you'll see that just kind of pop up, and you got to be in tune to that. The emotional intelligence of people baffle me sometimes with their lack of being able to hide if you just look for it. So, you know, toxic teams to me are the ones that have those individuals that are just going rogue. And more importantly, they're starting to bring down other people. And so when I quickly identify that, we have a really honest, transparent talk. And if it doesn't change, and we have a talk about maybe this is not the thing for you. Maybe I find somebody else that you can use your talents and the way you operate and to help you, you know, find something that you are good at, because this is not it.
So how long do you wait? So let's say you obviously you're leading a team. How long do you wait before you jump in and have that one-on-one? Do you let things play out for a little while, or do you just notice right away this person is going rogue, we're going to nip this real quick? Or, you know, so how quickly do you jump into that situation?
Yeah, I mean, it varies. It depends on the level of toxic that they're bringing to my team. But honestly, I try to help first. I mean, I think if you go in and show them that you're trying to help and you want to help them get to where they want to be professionally, I think it can be very valuable for the other team. Now, what you got to be careful of is if you start to show that person more attention than the ones that are actually doing what they're supposed to do, then it can have the opposite effect. So for me, it's when I recognize something, it's usually a quick one-on-one discussion and say, hey, look, it could be different things. It could be like, look, I noticed something, you know, just want to, you should need to keep an eye on that, or just something real subtle. Or it could be like, look, I've heard you talking about this activity in a really negative light, and I can't have you bringing down the whole team. If you have a problem with it, bring it to me. Let's discuss it, get it out, I can't have you influencing their team. You need to be a leader, you know, and just try to change the narrative between the individuals. So, you know, it varies per team.
So in dealing with a team, you are constantly trying to develop them, and because you want to grow, you, like you said, you got the scoreboard, you want to make sure you hit that, exceed that. So what do you do as the leader to equip your team to become the best they can be?
Most of the time it's just the continuous support and being there for them, understanding what they're going through in life and acknowledging it, and finding out where they want to be, have great conversations of what, you know, where you see yourself in 2 years and how can I help you get the powerful things that I do with the team. I got a team of over 17 people that I kind of lead. Whenever you find yourself in a day as a leader, like I'm the leader of this team, with a little bit of time, I am very purposeful, and we have a little, you know, a jabber is a little internal texting mechanism we have. And I'm always looking for opportunities just to hit them on a quick text and say, is there anything I can do for you today? And it's one of the most powerful things that I learned to how to do, because it the equity that I talk about gaining that equity in their professional lives with me. If I do that, because I'd always want to be the guy that calls them when I need something.
Right. Yeah.
I want to be the guy that calls them and just make sure they're okay. Anything I can do for you today. And that's really a powerful thing to do with your customers, with your partners, with whatever, your friends, because you never want to be the guy that just takes. I call it my team matrix. I have my whole team laid out on a Excel spreadsheet, and I'll just put a little check beside the ones that I make sure I contact everybody sometime during the week with a, how's things going? What can I do for you? And I think what it's given me is the ability to, when I actually do need something, I'm not coming to them like, oh gosh, well, you know, this is, he needs it. I actually had a name for it in my team. The last team I led, I called it a safe word, and it was called P-knuckle. Because here's the thing, at the end of the day, and I use this in with my wife sometimes too, is my job is to protect you from all the stuff that just bogs down your day. I want to protect you. I want to say no for you. I want to keep all the mess off your desk so you can do your job better. And so, but every once in a while, there's something that just has to be done. Mm-hmm. And so if I've proven that I've done everything I can to say no and keep it, you know, off your desk, when I come into you and I say, all right, guys, P-knuckle, I need you to do this, this, and this. And they're always like, okay, there's no question. P-knuckle means there's no questions. I just got to do it. And it's just a funny way that, and what's funny about my boss at work had found out about this, and he started using it. Hey, I asked you to get this form or whatever filled out. Did you P-knuckle that? I'm like, no, I didn't P-knuckle that. That's not an urgent request. He said, well, I need you to P-knuckle it. You know, it just became like this adjective for, you know, I got to get it done. So,
yeah. So you bring up a good point. How do you think it is best for people to lead from the middle? So you lead a team, and there's people in the team that want to influence. You've got bosses. So at Cisco, so how do you personally leverage not only you leading your team, but how do you also influence upward as well? Because you want to care for the people downward. You want to empower them, equip them, care for them, lead them well. But you also have the same thing on the other side of you. You got people that are probably trying to lead you well and direct you. So how do you navigate? I think this is one of the big, it's kind of the second chair leadership, in other words, or leading from the middle. What are a few things that you picked up or are aware of when it comes to that?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's easy to say, I want to be led the way I lead, but it hardly ever works that way. You know, so leading from the middle, I'm a middle manager in my company. I manage down and I got to manage up. And some of the same principles that I try to bring to my team, I actually bring to the team that I'm on. I have the team that I lead. I have the team that I'm on with my leader. And so I try to do the same things. I ping my colleagues, you know, anything I can do for you to help. I ping my boss probably about every other week, say, hey, look, is there anything I can help take off your plate? And I think at the heart of it all is the servant mentality. It really is for me. It's if you go come to it and you're honest and genuine about trying to help, it really forms a foundation of good leadership. I think that's where you lead from. You lead from a place of goodness, from a heart. And you know, at work, what I've noticed, man, as I'm managing up to my bosses, I look for opportunities to help them, and then they become almost reliant on my support and my help, and they start bringing things to me that I probably aren't even equipped or shouldn't even be handling. But I've proven that I'm there and not trying to cut their legs out. I'm actually coming beside them and trying to be a business partner. And I get a lot of access to other things that I probably otherwise shouldn't, just because I came from a place of trying to help them.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit as we get ready to wrap up. Let's talk a little bit about mindset. So you went from playing Little League to Garner to ECU to the pros, and then you played on a couple of different teams in the pros, and then back down to minors, and then out of baseball. What were some of the things that you did to help your own mindset? Because I can't imagine what it feels like to maybe get called into the coach's office and go, hey, Pat, appreciate your time here, but now you're heading out to Colorado. Hey, thanks for being here, Pat, but now we're sending you here. And how do you deal with that? Because if you're not careful, you look at that like, well, I guess I failed. You know, I guess I wasn't good enough, I guess, to be in Cincinnati. So now I'm gone to some other team. I wasn't good enough there, which obviously you're good enough to play at that level. But even as you just said, you know, there's people that are coming up all the time that are better or just as good. So what is the mindset that you had to get into to keep you motivated, to keep you encouraged? Because it's not a failure by any means, but if people are listening and they're on a team and maybe they got, you know, let go, or they're getting shifted to another team, or everybody else is getting promoted and they're staying exactly where they are, what's the mindset that you have when it comes to that?
Yeah, well, I was always taught, me and my parents being who they were, a foundation of faith, and that a sport doesn't define me. Mm. And it doesn't define me in many ways. It doesn't define me spiritually. It doesn't define me economically. I knew that this is a really long life we got to live, and this is just a short little pit stop of a job that I have. And, and coming from where I was, I mean, I'm 6 foot, 100 nothing. I should never have made it to the major leagues. I was just in the right place, right time, had some talent, had some coaches that believed in me, and I, you know, worked my way to the big leagues. And so I always had this perspective of this is going to stop at some point. And what I want to do is stay here as long as I can. I want to absorb it. I want to take it all in as a unbelievable opportunity in life that the, you know, only 0.001% of the population get to even, only 0.1% of the baseball players get to do what I did.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was just such a cool time in my life, but it did not define me. And I've had lots of baseball players that have never recuperated from not being able to play again. And one of the hardest things to do as an athlete is to self-evaluate. It's to take a step back and say, well, where do I fit in this world? Where do I fit in baseball? What is my, you know, where do I fall in line of talent? And it's really hard to do. And so when it's time to hang it up, if you built your foundation on a game, it will crumble. At some point in everybody's life, Tom Brady, name it, he will not be able to play football anymore.
I hope that time comes soon as a Bills fan.
Yeah, yeah. You know, as for the Bills, like, you know, nobody can play, so it really doesn't matter.
That's true.
But at some point, you had to be able to fall back on a foundation of something else. And for me, it's always been my faith. But I was very thankful that my parents built that into me early, and so I try to do it in my kids. And back to the being the even keel of not being a tail if you go 0-4 or 4-4, being that steady force will allow me to not, you know, position myself of success based off the performance on the field. And what's really unique is I'm looking at our kids, and you know, the kids today, they become very entitled. Look, I've been on mission trips. You've been on way more than I have, but you've seen what struggle is in the world, and our kids do not struggle. And so the reason I love sports and specifically baseball being a game of failure is that you take a step back and look what we're creating with sports and take what you really should be taking out of it instead of, hey, my kid's going to play in the big leagues. You should take out that, look, they don't have struggle in their lives. We have to manufacture struggle for them. They are going to go home and they're going to have food. They're going to have shelter. They're going to have a bed. They're going to have Xbox. They're going to have all the things that they desire in life when they go home from this game. Is that really what's preparing them for life? They need to fail. When I coach teams in baseball, one of my favorite things is when we lose, is they get to come in and say, guys, I love this game because I saw you struggle. And at the end of the day, if you don't struggle, you don't know how to overcome it. And so, you know, as in a society that we're blessed like we are, we have to manufacture struggle, and we do it by sports. That's the only way that we as parents can kind of sometimes do that, because they just don't struggle.
Man, that is extremely powerful, Pat. I love you nailed it. You nailed it in how we define ourselves, and the people who define themselves, whether by sport or their career, eventually that's going to go away. And so that's a very, very strong way to wrap up this entire conversation. So a couple final questions and thoughts that are pretty fun. I'd love to know this. What is one of your biggest highlights from playing in the Major League Baseball, just personally? What's one of the things you look back on and you just remember and it puts a smile on your face?
Yeah, the first time I got to call my parents and tell them that I got promoted to the big leagues. Uh-huh. I was in Buffalo.
Hey, there
we
were
playing the Triple A team for Buffalo. Uh-huh.
The Bisons, right? Isn't that the Bisons?
The Bisons, yeah. Nice little downtown stadium. Uh-huh. It was nice. Yep. And they had just beat us in the Triple A playoffs in 1997, September the 8th. I remember the date because my manager calls me and says, "Hey, Pat, I was prepared to go home. Like I had my car packed or whatever, back in Indianapolis, where I was playing at." And he called me and said, "Hey, we're sending you to the big leagues." And I was like, "Oh my gosh!" And so I got to call my father and my mother. I got them on the phone, and uh-huh. I said, "Hey, I'm not coming home tomorrow. I'm not going to drive home." They were like, "Wow, what happened?" I was like, "I need you to get to Cincinnati because I got called to the big leagues."
Oh, man, that's awesome.
And so that was one of the favorite phone calls I ever got to make for them, because I know the hard work and the resources they used to get me where I'm at. And so my mother hated to fly, but she climbed on the plane that next day, and she was in Riverfront Stadium for my opening day. Yeah.
So what was it like your first time you played center field? What was it like your first time stepping out into that stadium on that grass? What is that? How's that even? Can you even explain what that feels like?
No, you really can. And I use this. I tell the story a lot. Ever since I started playing baseball in Little League, you know, at some point in the game, right before the game starts, usually the national anthem, my head's down. And I say a little prayer before I play. And so when I open my eyes, I'm looking down at my feet, and it's just a little patch of grass that I'm looking at. And I kind of say my prayer, and I look up, and then there in Little League, it was just a small little stand. Well, as you get to high school, I look down at my little patch of grass, and I look up, the stadium's getting a little bigger, then college, a little bigger. And then I look up in the minor leagues, it's bigger. And then I can remember the first time I looked down in the big leagues at my little patch of grass. The patch of grass hadn't changed. When I look up, it's a stadium.
Yeah.
And so it's still the same game. It's still Pat. It's still my little patch of grass, but the surroundings have completely changed. And I just remember being how lucky I am to get to play a game for a living and get to experience this. It was just a cool way to reflect back on all the things that I've done to get to this point. This is the pinnacle.
Yeah. Yeah, that is awesome. All right. One final question. Probably the most important question of the day. At the time of this recording, it is March, and there's March Madness that is happening. And here in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's kind of a big deal. Pat, who's winning? Who's winning it all?
Easy. Oh. Zion. I'm just going to say that I don't have to say Z.
Just him. Just him.
Let me just tell you, you take Zion off of Duke, they're a 6 seed. But as long as Zion is in the game, I'm happy. No, I honestly, it's I predicted a Carolina Duke final. That was just my dream because I think this place would just explode.
Yeah,
and
yeah, I did the same thing.
But I think it's, you know, wishful thinking. I just really want to see Zion win it because I just think he's the most talented player I've seen come through in a very, very long time. He's a special guy.
It's fun to watch. That is for sure. Yeah, I'm hoping for a Carolina Duke final as well, just because of that'll be number four this year, right? The fourth time this year in the finals. Yeah. And that'd be pretty awesome. Well, Pat, thank you so incredibly much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today. And for all you listening, I hope you enjoyed this conversation talking with Pat Watkins on teamwork and leadership. And as always, I appreciate your time and thank you for listening. And we will catch you again on our next podcast.